Sunday is Veterans Day, and not just any Veterans Day. It is also the 100th anniversary of the day that became Veterans Day, the date of the signing of the armistice that ended World War I, November 11th, 1918. World War I is a distant memory. It's quite likely that no one who remembers it is still living. Not so with the American War in Vietnam. We can't get our minds off that war and all the damage it did to our people in Asia and to our society here at home. Our guest this hour looks at the war's impact here, but not across all of society. Andrew Wiest examines the impact on the wives of American soldiers in Vietnam in his book, Charlie Company's Journey Home. Andrew Wiest is a professor of history at the University of Southern Mississippi and the founding director of the Dale Center for the Study of War and Society there. Dr. Wiest's work focuses on, what do you know, World War I and Vietnam. Andrew Wiest, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
You've actually done some teaching in military settings, too, I noticed. Tell us about that.
Sure. I was lucky enough to have a stint at the Royal Military Academy. Never had Harry or William as one of my students, but I certainly got to know people who taught them, and also taught at the United States Air Force Air War College. So I think it's an important thing for a historian who likes to write about the military and its experience to have experienced it from the inside. And I'm lucky enough to have done it on a couple different continents.
That is impressive. And I wanted to ask you, too, now that I see that your work focuses on World War I as well as Vietnam, is it just my imagination or is the United States kind of just leaving the centennial of the World War I armistice off to one side?
We've done a pretty good job of forgetting that war. I'm blessed enough to take students over to Europe almost every summer. And we traipsed some battlefields over there, World War I ones and World War II ones. And when we go to a place like the Normandy American Cemetery, that's always crowded. When we go to the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, the cemetery that marks America's longest and most costly battle, we're always alone when we're in there. It's like somehow that war never permeated the American consciousness very deeply, perhaps because World War II supplanted it, but it's just something that Americans, and it was such an important turning point in so many aspects of American history. It's a shame that we've forgotten it.
Truly, and we seem to be in no danger of forgetting the Vietnam War. I mean, how would you compare our continued riveting focus? I was just looking at the numbers, for example, for Ken Burns' Vietnam series a year ago, and they were pretty phenomenal for a PBS show.
Well, I mean, to be honest, we're just hitting that period to where the Vietnam War is actively becoming history. For a good period after any war, the exchange is dominated by participants in the war, usually with some dog in the hunt on one side or the other. And then slowly, as the generation that participated in the war ages, it begins to transform into history as younger people who are not a part of the war write about it. And so the same kind of thing you saw with Reagan at Omaha Beach transforming World War II into the almost industry that it became. The Vietnam War is hitting about that same period in its history. And so I do think we're going to see it become something of a topic to be wrestled with more as the baby boom generation that fought it begins to retire and begins to consume and write history in a different way.
Right, especially because they're coming up on the within a few years, the 50th anniversary of the end of the war or
right.
Involvement in it. So your previous book was called The Boys of 67. Did that book lead directly to this one?
It sure did. That book, I felt through teaching classes and getting to know veterans and taking students to Vietnam, I kind of felt that Vietnam veterans had become more of a political point scoring thing. You use them as weapons or victims in history as opposed to really attempt to understand them as people in their combat experience. So what I wanted to do was look at the combat experience of one unit, again, rather like Stephen Ambrose did with World War II, pick out one combat company and just kind of try to understand the young men who went to war and what war did to them. And so that book, that's essentially what it does, mainly through oral interviews, looks at the combat experience of one heavily drafted company, 160 men, only one of whom was a non-draftee and enlistee. So these were young men drafted in May of 1966, fought in 1967, and returned home in 1968.
Wow, one non-draftee. That's amazing. That is so different from what the military is like now. This book starts with a very frightening episode, a Vietnam vet holding a gun on his wife. What was happening there?
To put it bluntly, the guys that I became so familiar with in Charlie Company, as I began, that's the company that Boys 67 focuses on, that they suffered a very difficult year in Vietnam. Of the 160 men who went, 26 were killed and 105 were wounded. And again, that book focused specifically on the men. As I got to know the people in the unit better, I've been to several of their reunions. They've kind of adopted me as their, I guess, historian mascot. I got to know the wives better, the people who had been with these men now for 50 years in some cases. And their stories were just overwhelming. And when I was searching for a kind of vignette to begin this book, kind of with a hook that it needs, one of the veterans, Jose Sauceda, Texas veteran, his memories of the war just got too much for him one night, and he pulled his gun. He was a policeman at the time, pulled his gun on his wife. And that was... they're still married, happily so. Raised a happy family, but that moment was transformative for them and their understanding of what Vietnam had done to him.
So ultimately, some redemption. We have a lot more stories to talk about with Andrew Wiest in his book Charlie Company's Journey Home. It looks at the lives of the wives of the soldiers of Charlie Company and how they dealt with all the things they had to deal with waiting for their husbands to come home, and also what life was like once they did. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone or email. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Wiest and Charlie Company's Journey Home in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the Vietnam War with historian Andrew Wiest from the University of Southern Mississippi. He's the founding director of the Dale Center for the Study of War and Society there, and has written a book about Vietnam War families. He focused on Charlie Company in his last book, The Boys of 67. This time we get to learn about the people they left behind when they went to Vietnam. It's called Charlie Company's Journey Home, The Forgotten Impact on the Wives of Vietnam Veterans. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on the Exchange. Your questions, your comments, some experiences to share, perhaps. 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Andrew, you do provide some good numbers in the introduction. With all those guys in country, how many people were waiting back here for them to come home?
It's actually a surprising number. I was expecting to find so few wives, because there were the typical view of the Vietnam War is, of course, 18, 19-year-old draftees off fighting and, you know, maybe coming home to their mom and apple pie once the war's over, or perhaps protests on the other side of things. But the numbers indicate that right around 30% of the veterans were married, and with 3 million total veterans over there, this is going to be just under a million wives waiting for them. So it's a huge untold story. Certainly, historians have done a very good job at looking at how wars impact women and gender in general. But the kind of one unstudied part is, what about those women and their children who have sent a young man off to war? How do they experience what their young husband is going through? And it's a quite impactful moment for those women and their marriages.
Truly, but and yet I don't know why. I love this detail in the book. The women you interviewed almost universally wanted to know why you wanted to talk to them.
That very much surprised me as well. Again, I'd already written a book about their husbands, so when I called up kind of for the second go around, they almost immediately all handed me over to their husbands. Says, no, I want to talk to you. And they universally said, well, my husband made history, not me. I don't have a story to tell. Which again kind of indicates how little emphasis has been put on this topic. Now, almost every book you read says the war was difficult, meaning any war. The war was difficult on the families who were left behind. It's almost a trope when you're discussing war, but really nobody's ever looked at it. And so they were very surprised when I wanted to look at it.
It is easy to forget with what we know about the 60s historically now, with talk of civil rights and women's rights in the 60s, that even for the baby boomers, there were somewhat limited expectations for young women.
Yes. Very few of these women, again, these are people who graduated usually in 1964 or 65. Relatively few of them expected to go on to college or to their own career. Almost all of them looked forward to marriage, meaning that my cohort of women married very young. The youngest was 16. The oldest one, who was convinced she would never get married, she was a very unhappy old maid. She was 25. So they married extremely young and were looking for that, you know, white picket fence, 2.3 children, whatever, the kind of vision of a woman's place in America that their parents had had.
But several of them did pursue more education and, in fact, careers, didn't they?
Yes. What I found was that many of the families, when the husband returns, of course, there's going to be some level of difficulty. Many of the husbands return with PTSD, which, is, of course, is not recognized for years yet. And just the difficulty of raising families in general in that time in the world's history, almost all the wives have to go out and get a job. Many of them as the primary breadwinner because of the difficulties their husbands are facing. So they looked forward to one kind of future, and in every case, Vietnam altered that future for them.
Andrew Weiss is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Charlie Company's Journey Home, subtitled The Forgotten Impact on the Wives of Vietnam Veterans. Haven't asked about the overall impact on Charlie Company. You mentioned 160 men in this unit. One of them was not drafted. The rest were. What was their record on coming home, wounded or not?
The entire, if you get down to the entire numbers, of the 160 who went over there, 130 come home either wounded or don't come home at all, leaving. It's a real rarity for a combat unit sent to Vietnam in this year to not see that type of casualty rate. So all these men have to either deal with having their best friend wounded or killed, or in their cases being wounded themselves. Many of them are quite badly wounded. A few of them return home without limbs. A few of them return home to, even though they retain all their limbs, are physically disabled for the rest of their lives with some other form of physical malady. Vietnam is a physical thing that almost all of the veterans have to live with. And, of course, their wives have to get used to a husband who's physically different than what he was when he went over.
You mentioned that that the women were married sometimes at 16, as late as 25. I mean, when the couples got together, the war was obviously already going. And I'm just curious, because this is about the point when opinion begins to turn against the war, too. And I'm just wondering what the view of it was, whether it was like, oh, you know, I might get drafted, but I'm okay with that, or if there was a bit more reticence about it, reluctance to want to go and think about.
Well, this unit is actually in a transitional period. When they're drafted at the beginning of 1966, the war is still outrageously popular. When they return home in January of 68, that the war has really changed. So the country's view of the war changes while they're gone. So there's really none of the men consider running away to Canada or anything like that. Almost all of them consider it a signal honor to have been called up by their country. Of course, things have changed when they return home. America's soured on the war, which means that these guys who are vaguely aware that there's been some changes in America while they're gone, they're stunned when they're met at the airports on their way home by protesters. In fact, most of them, when there's a crowd at the airport, think they're being welcomed home, and it hurts them quite deeply when that turns out not to be the case.
Wow, and I just can't imagine what it would have been like then to come back from Vietnam to America in 1968, one of the most upheaval-filled and violent years in our political history, certainly.
It was quite difficult on the men. Most of the stories that I heard were, of course, very difficult times in Vietnam. But all of the veterans, all of them, single out their return home as perhaps the most impactful moment of the entire war. Even men who held their best friends while they were dying had their return home and the negative response they got as the most impactful event, which I really did not expect to find out.
Wow. That's, on the other end of their experience, though, I mean, when they left, I mean, you know, societal views aside, I just wonder what the view was of the people who knew they were going to be taking up arms. Was there a heroic "we'll fix this" like in World War II, or was there something else by that point?
At the beginning, there certainly was. They believed in what they were told about the war. They believed that, like most Americans did, that by the time they got home, the war would be over. The wives had a bit of a longer view of it because the way this tends to work out is almost all these couples got married while the soldier was off in training. And why that happens is there is some understanding that the soldier might not make it back. And that's universally why they get married. They want to be married before this risk takes place because they may never have a chance to do it. So there is an understanding that the soldier might die, but that understanding really doesn't sink in all that deep. The wives, they know their husband, who they really don't know very well. They've been high school sweethearts. They really haven't had a chance to live together. Most of the wives are still living at home with their parents. A couple actually have to go live with their in-laws, which I can only imagine having to do with your loved one away at war. You're suddenly moving in with in-laws at age 18. Even without the war, it would have been a transformative moment for these families. But the war just magnifies it so much.
We're talking about the Vietnam War with Andrew Wiest, a historian at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's the author of Charlie Company's Journey Home, The Forgotten Impact on the Wives of Vietnam Veterans. He talked to many of the wives of Charlie Company, this unit that went off to war in 1967 and went into the Army in 1966, came home in 1968. You can join the conversation on the exchange, either to share some thoughts about your own experience in the Vietnam years, wherever they were lived, or to talk about what we're talking about here in front of us. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Andrew, there's a big difference, you point out, between the bonding that the guys had in training and what the women experienced away from training.
Right. The guys are provided with a community, and if you know how veterans function, it's the tightest community of their lives. So veterans often become much more close with each other than they will, even with those wives who left behind or children they later have. Those memories and camaraderie born of first training, then tempered in combat, it's an amazingly close community. The wives never have that. Most of the wives cannot go to training with their husbands, and so they remain at home. Maybe the husband will come home for a party before he leaves, which is going to be a pretty sad party anyway. But the wives are surrounded by people who don't understand what they're going through. Most of their generational compatriots are, you know, wondering should they like Jimi Hendrix or should they like the Beatles, and they're worried about, you know, getting the latest fashion. These women are worried about can they find news on their husband? The letters have stopped coming. Does that mean he's dead? It's a very different experience for them. And sadly enough, when the husbands come home, almost to a man, they refuse to talk about what happened. And that also still leaves the wives alone. The one person that they could commiserate with is the husband, and the husband too often, in an effort to protect the wife, leaves her in the dark.
That was a question I was going to ask a little later, but here we are. The idea of it certainly seems. I mean, there's a view of the 1950s, whether it is fair or not, that it was a real stiff upper lip time, that people who fought in World War II didn't talk about it, and it sounds like that certainly came through to the people who came back from Vietnam as well.
It really did, and the kind of way I came to define it and deal with it in my own head as an author, these men have realized that they've been through an extremely abnormal situation in which they've both experienced death and taken part in killing, both of which are transformative experiences. It's the most abnormal world you can imagine, and each of them wants to return to normality. And the one normal thing in the world is their wife or their wife and children, if they happen to have children. And they fear that telling the wife and child about their experience will somehow alter that, that it'll drag them into the dirtiness that was Vietnam. And they don't want that dirtiness to cloud their family life or cloud their future. So they want to bury it. They want to leave it behind, which, of course, just causes it to fester.
Right. So they're compartmentalizing. And
things are
they're growing interest on their principle there when it's in that that box. You mentioned wives and children. How many of these people had kids when they went off to war?
Pretty much the entire of the there were 28 married couples I was able to locate in this company.
Uh-huh.
And of that group, I was able to locate 22 wives and interview them. And almost all of them have children. Again, that's the husbands are trying to leave a legacy before they leave. The wives desperately want family, and they want family with this man because they've chosen him and he's chosen them. So almost all the couples have children by the time the husband gets back. 15 children are born while the men are gone. So there are plenty of wives in this story who are going through the experience of childbirth on their own without their husband.
Well, and I should point out the book is illustrated as well. We have pictures of the people you talk to, and boy, do those pictures tell some stories. The picture of Jacqueline Bradfield with her two kids, they look like siblings. She's so young.
Yes, she was one of the very youngest brides. She was 16 when she was married, had to leave high school because she was pregnant with her child. She had grown up in a very difficult circumstance and was desperate to find love and camaraderie, and she found that with her husband, John. Loved him dearly, almost immediately had children, loved being a mother, but John was very much changed by the war. And their marriage eventually fell apart because of Vietnam. I suspect there's no way it would have fallen apart otherwise.
Well, before people start feeling bad for all the couples, I mean, there's actually a fair number of pictures in here of people who are well into their 70s and 80s now who they're still together.
That's actually one thing that really surprised me is when I got, because these marriages are born of the most difficult circumstances imaginable. And of my sample group, 25% wind up getting divorced, with another couple divorcing and then remarrying. And when I stack that up against other marriages that took place in 1966, 50% of civilian couples who got married in that year divorced. So these marriages born of such difficulty actually are more durable than the marriages of everybody else.
Wow. We were talking about the young, Jacqueline Bradfield, 16 years old, got a couple of kids in pretty short order with John Bradfield and Charlie Company. At the other end of the age spectrum, let's talk about the Windmillers, because they were a bit older and
yes,
not typical the rest of the bunch, and you start chuckling immediately.
Yes, they had a very different experience. They'd been married a decade before the war. He was the battalion chaplain, making him the oldest guy in the unit as well and the highest-ranking guy. And to me, the most interesting aspect of their marriage, having a marriage that's been around and been comfortable and already been sorted out, is very different than having these urgent young marriages that are just beginning. And this family already had three children, and Esther Bradfield, Bernie was a preacher. And she had lived in the microcosm of a preacher's world, and she had lived in his shadow for years. And while he was gone, she stepped out of his shadow. She took over the family finances and was the number one person in the family. And there was this wonderful letter from Bernie to her, because he had seen this happen from afar through the letters, where he says, you know, honey, I'm going to have to take back the leadership of the family, my proper role in the family when I got back. That didn't happen. Their marriage was renegotiated and became much stronger as a result, and they're still happily together. But that was one thing that I really wasn't expecting to find in this narrative, was that the wives, they become independent in a way that they never expected while their husband is gone.
Well, so he really rolled with the change then.
Yes, they really did. He was surprised. As a chaplain, he was called to counseling one day, and he thought he would be giving the counseling as the chaplain, but no, the counseling was marriage counseling for him and his wife. So he was a little surprised by that. But again, once he came to the understanding that war had changed him, which he expected, but war had also changed her, which he hadn't. He hadn't expected that at all.
So he had to counsel all these people, I'm sure, in the unit and deal with things like their deaths, I would think. He probably saw a lot of that.
He sure did. He had to write home over 60 letters to next of kin about, because he was not only Charlie Company's chaplain, he was the whole company, battalion's chaplain. So every death in the unit, he felt it quite personally.
Well, okay, much more to talk about with Andrew Wiest, who's the author of the book Charlie Company's Journey Home, The Forgotten Impact on the Wives of Vietnam Veterans. This is a follow-up to Andrew's earlier book, The Boys of 67, and the subtitle for this book is The Boys of 67 and the War They Left Behind. We're learning a lot about what it was like to be waiting for a husband to return from Vietnam and to face the awful possibility that he would either not return or return but heavily damaged. A lot of that did happen, as we're learning from our discussion with Andrew. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone or email. We'll come back and talk more with Andrew about Charlie Company's Journey Home here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Andrew Wiest, a historian at the University of Southern Mississippi, focusing on World War I and Vietnam, the founding director of the Dale Center for the Study of War and Society at USM. You can join the conversation as we talk about his book, Charlie Company's Journey Home, The Forgotten Impact on the Wives of Vietnam Veterans. We're learning a lot about what the Vietnam War was like, not there, but here on the home front, trying to start a marriage, trying to start a family, when half of the relationship is overseas. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And I did mention, because it's election week and there's a lot to talk about, that we're going to be waiving the one call per week rule. And here taking advantage of that is Rika in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Yeah, I'm a widow of a Vietnam vet, but I was his second wife. His first wife divorced him while he was in Nam.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how much did he talk to you about his experiences?
A little bit. He did mention he was rode a helicopter down to the ground,
auto rotation
11 times.
Wow.
That's a big, and so I mean, was it something that was with him all the time, or was he able to move on with his life?
Well, he definitely had PTSD. Took me about 7 years to realize what's going on there. He couldn't hold a job, and because he was thinking, subconsciously, as soon as he'd been there for a year, he'd be thinking he was in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he stayed for an extra tour after his wife divorced him.
Wow.
And then he went back and basically deserted the wife and kids. He stayed in Alaska, where they didn't have any extradition for things like child support.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. All right, so it's sort of a spotty record there. Thanks for sharing the story there, Rika. Appreciate it. But you mentioned already, Andrew, that there were a fair number of, not that many divorces, actually, compared to the overall population, you were just saying.
Right, and that's not to say the marriages weren't, in some cases, riven with difficulties because of Vietnam. But what I came to believe was that these wives become veterans in their own right, in the sense that Vietnam comes to dominate their husbands. They know they send a young man to war who is one thing and get a young man back from the war who's different, perhaps darker, perhaps drinking. They almost, rather like the military refuses to leave a man behind on the battlefield, these women realized that their husbands were altered by circumstances well beyond their control, and that they want to hang with them. They view themselves as comrades, and it's quite touching how the wives become part of this Vietnam narrative. They don't remain separate from it, even though the husbands try to make that happen. They certainly don't achieve that, and the wives refuse to leave a man behind on the battlefield, in this case the battlefield of marriage after a war.
You mentioned several points in the book. We really get a sense of the loneliness that the women are feeling. You know, soon after marriage, they're alone and sometimes living in their in-laws' houses, as you mentioned. Did they ever get to support each other very much?
Actually, not very much. Charlie Company, after about, well, it's the late 80s, so 20 years or so after the men have returned, Charlie Company begins to have reunions. And the wives do see each other at the reunion sometimes and realize they're not alone, realize that there are other women out there going through the same things and familial issues that they are. But then the reunions last for a day or two and they go home. Some remain in touch, but they don't have the same kind of support groups ever that their husbands will, like the VA or the VFW or things like that, where husbands can gather with other men like them who've been through similar experiences. The wives all too rarely, to this day, haven't found anybody with similar experiences.
There's a quote in the book from Kay Lukes that rings very true. It was hard to build a marriage without Larry there. I mean, and how, you know, because since so few people have exposure to the military anymore, how long would the absences be?
The absences for these men, they went through 8 months of training, usually with a couple of breaks interspersed in there. But those breaks were short, and to be brutally honest, the husband spent most of those breaks asleep because they were pretty worn out from training. And then the husband shipped out for a year of combat and were overseas for 365 days. Many of them did receive an R&R to Hawaii that lasted a week, a rest and relaxation trip to Hawaii. Some were able to make that trip, some weren't. Some wives were able to get to Hawaii and see their husbands, and some weren't because of their family obligations. Then what's often forgotten is when the man returns home, he still owes some military obligation to the country. So usually they're home for a week or two and ship out again to another, in this case, stateside military deployment. So pretty much 2 years the husband is gone, both in training, then in combat, and then a little bit of post-combat military service.
And the women you talked to, how good were their husbands at writing home, keeping the loved ones up on what was happening to them?
The husbands wrote religiously, as did the wives. It was the one tether they had to remain connected. Of course, the letters took 2 weeks to arrive, or said the news was almost always stale, which meant the wives only found out about bad stuff almost a month after it happened. So that always left them on tenterhooks. Do they read newspapers? Do they watch the television, or do they wait for letters? And how the wives dealt with that was quite different depending on who they were. And the husbands, with two exceptions, really did not write home about the bad stuff. They didn't want their wife to worry for them because, again, the wives are an entire ocean away. There's nothing they can do to impact the war. So most of the husbands hid the bad stuff from the wives, only wrote about camaraderie and sent home pictures of them and their buddies horsing around. The couple of husbands who did write home about the bad stuff, it really impacted their wives deeply.
So this is the war that, you know, everybody called at the time Vietnam, the first television war. This is the one that we could actually see reports on within usually a day or two of the time it happened. So, I mean,
yes,
it was they could see what was going on in Vietnam. While they're waiting for the journey of a letter to take 2 weeks to reach them. What was that like?
It was as nerve-wracking could be because, I mean, there's so many American troops over there when Charlie Company is there. It's, again, 160 men out of essentially 500,000 men. So you, unless you know military lexicon and the reporters are real good at telling you what they're seeing, you don't know whether that's your husband on TV or not. Chances are slim that it's your husband, but anytime a unit comes on television, anytime you see something explode, there is that. Is that John? Is that Bernie? And you don't know until the letter comes, and the letter's going to be 2 weeks after you saw that. So there's this horrible indecision on the part of the wives the whole time.
You provide some comic relief in the part where we're learning about the letters, though, because you let us know about Becky Lind getting her husband's toenail in the mail. What was that?
Yes, the husband, you kind of have to keep the humor and stuff alive while you're over there. He had damaged his foot while he was over there and had to have his toenail surgically removed. And he actually included that in the letter home in which he was telling his wife about the procedure. And she felt something in the envelope and shook it, and his toenail plopped out, which kind of caused her to jump a little bit. But she still has that toenail because it meant a lot to her. It meant that her was okay. I mean, still trying to play jokes on her meant that he was okay, not just physically okay, but that in Vietnam was still Herb, the guy who acted like Herb and joked around like Herb. He was still there.
And did Herb Lind come home?
Herb Lind did come home. He was the company commander. Of the 28 wives, six of them had husbands who did not make it through the war, and of those six, I was able to track down an interview too.
So for the men who did come home, I'm just curious to know once the women were back with their husbands, how different they seemed to them. Was there a common thread there?
All the husbands look greatly physically different. In fact, well, they're in the best shape of their lives, and they've lost a lot of weight, almost all of them. A couple of the wives mentioned the smell. Their husbands smell different because they smell like jungle in Vietnam, and they just have to take a bath before they can go much further. But every wife mentioned that the husband was different, because to survive in the struggle that was Vietnam, you have to be hyper alert because death could be anywhere. So you're always on a hair trigger. You have to be not only hyper alert, but you've lost so many people that you're emotionally quite different than you were. The husbands have learned how to cut themselves off from human relations because it hurts too much to lose somebody that you're close to. So the husbands are emotionally different. They're physically different. They react to things different. Almost all of them had started drinking while they were over there to help them cope. So the wives see this immediately. The husbands don't notice it because it's like watching a child grow. If you're there around that child for a year, you may kind of understand they're bigger, but if you haven't seen that child, you're shocked by how different they are. The husbands don't realize how much they've changed. The wives pick up on it instantly.
Well, and of course, these guys were not very far away from being children themselves.
No, they weren't. They were in their late teens, fresh out of high school.
Well, let's take a call here. John and Vanita, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Wiest, the author of Charlie Company's Journey Home.
Thank you for this conversation. I'm of that generation, but I did not go to Vietnam. I was very fortunate to have a seat at kind of the round table of all these vets that kept coming back from Vietnam. I worked for the Forest Service, and it's a hire the vet priority. So there was many, many guys I met over a period of that number of years, about 4 years, from 69 to 74. And I made my strongest friendships with those people. These guys didn't just have to grow up fast and hard. They had to grow up big and strong, or they just didn't come back. Mm-hmm. And what I'm calling for is, I want to also mention the Korean veterans. They're kind of a forgotten bunch,
right?
Too.
Yes, that's fair.
Very much.
You know,
so.
Yeah, but what I want everybody that could hear me, please think where our money goes in this stupid war machine. And what are we doing over there in the Middle East, or the Far East now, or wherever the hell, just wherever? What for? I mean, are we ever going to learn, as the old Paul Mary song goes?
Right. Anyway, when will they ever learn?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Well, so
that actually, one thing that I became clear when I was writing this book was that, there are wives and families going through this exact same thing right now, and who are, of course, their communications with their husbands are different because they're instantaneous, and the internet and the email communications they have, but their wives going through this same exact problem right now, and they still feel alone. So I was hoping that this book would resonate with some of the families who are dealing with these problems today, and maybe they could learn something from what the Vietnam-era families went through.
or take some comfort perhaps in the fact that they are other people who had to deal with this. And we talked about the losses that the wives of Charlie Company dealt with. So with now 50 years gone by, is there any uniformity among the women in what they think about the Vietnam War and the reasons for fighting and the conduct of it?
They tend to steer away from that. The men often like to get into discussions about, you know, the nature of their war, and always defending it, and you know, saying bad things about the protesters and whatnot. But because you can understand that, these guys sacrificed a huge chunk of their lives and their emotional well-being, and there's no way they're going to think that they sacrificed those things for something that wasn't pure and something that wasn't good. That's a question you just can't ask. The wives steer further away from those kind of questions. They're more about the, you know, how am I going to make my marriage work question. Is my husband, you know, suffering today? One thing we haven't covered is Agent Orange. A lot of these guys are have health problems that crop up later. The wives tend to deal with the softer issues of war. The more personal issues of war. None of them like protesters because they made their husbands, you know, pariahs for a number of years. So they don't have much time for that. But they tend to view war in a different way than their husbands.
Well, it's an amazing book that really lets us into the private lives of people who were very heavily impacted by the war. It's called Charlie Company's Journey Home, The Forgotten Impact on the Wives of Vietnam Veterans. It's the work of Andrew Wiest at the University of Southern Mississippi, historian there and founding director of the Dale Center for the Study of War and Society. Dr. Wiest, thank you so much.